She looked at him, unable to understand. But he was looking past her, straight ahead at the crane in the distance. She wished he had not said it. The accusation did not trouble her. She never thought of herself in such terms, and she was completely incapable of experiencing a feeling of fundamental guilt. But she felt a vague apprehension which she could not define, the suggestion that there was something of grave consequence in whatever had made him say it, something dangerous to him. He had not said it casually, but there had been no feeling in his voice, neither plea nor shame. He had said it indifferently, as a statement of fact. Then, as she watched him, the apprehension vanished. He was looking at his mills beyond the window. There was no guilt in his face, no doubt, nothing but the calm of an inviolate self-confidence. "Dagny," he said, "whatever we are, it's we who move the world, and it's we who'll pull it through." Chapter 5. The Climax of the Danconias. The newspaper was the first thing she noticed. It was clutched tightly in Eddie's hand as he entered her office. She glanced up at his face. It was tense and bewildered. "Dagny, are you very busy?" "Why?" "I know that you don't like to talk about him, but there's something here I think you ought to see." She extended her hand silently for the newspaper. The story on the front page announced that upon taking over the San Sebastian mines, the government of the People's State of Mexico had discovered that they were worthless. Blatantly, totally, hopelessly worthless. There was nothing to justify the 5 years of work and the millions spent. Nothing but empty excavations, laboriously cut. The few traces of copper were not worth the effort of extracting them. No great deposits of metal existed or could be expected to exist there, and there were no indications that could have permitted anyone to be deluded. The government of the People's State of Mexico was holding emergency sessions about their discovery in an uproar of indignation. They felt that they had been cheated. Watching her, Eddie knew that Dagny sat looking at the newspaper long after she had finished reading. He knew that he had been right to feel a hint of fear, even though he could not tell what frightened him about that story. He waited. She raised her head. She did not look at him. Her eyes were fixed, intent in concentration, as if trying to discern something at a great distance. He said, his voice low, "Francisco is not a fool. Whatever else he may be, no matter what depravity he sunk to, and I've given up trying to figure out why, he is not a fool. He couldn't have made a mistake of this kind. It is not possible. I don't understand it." "I'm beginning to." She sat up, jolted upright by a sudden movement that ran through her body like a shudder. She said, "Phone him at the Wayne Falkland and tell the bastard that I want to see him." "Dagny," he said sadly, reproachfully, "it's Frisco Danconia." It was. She walked through the early twilight of the city streets to the Wayne Falkland Hotel. "He says anytime you wish," Eddie had told her. The first lights appeared in a few windows high under the clouds. The skyscrapers looked like abandoned lighthouses sending feeble, dying signals out into an empty sea where no ships moved any longer. A few snowflakes came down past the dark windows of empty stores to melt in the mud of the sidewalks. A string of red lanterns cut the street, going off into the murky distance. She wondered why she felt that she wanted to run, that she should be running. No, not down this street, down a green hillside in the blazing sun to the road on the edge of the Hudson, at the foot of the Taggart estate. That was the way she always ran when Eddie yelled, "It's Frisco Danconia," and they both flew down the hill to the car approaching on the road below. He was the only guest whose arrival was an event in their childhood, their biggest event. The running to meet him had become part of a contest among the three of them. There was a birch tree on the hillside, halfway between the road and the house. Dagny and Eddie tried to get past the tree before Francisco could race up the hill to meet them. On all the many days of his arrivals, in all the many summers, they never reached the birch tree. Francisco reached it first and stopped them when he was way past it. Francisco always won, as he always won everything. His parents were old friends of the Taggart family. He was an only son, and he was being brought up all over the world. His father, it was said, wanted him to consider the world as his future domain. Dagny and Eddie could never be certain of where he would spend his winter, but once a year, every summer, a stern South American tutor brought him for a month to the Taggart estate. Francisco found it natural that the Taggart children should be chosen as his companions. They were the crown heirs of Taggart Transcontinental, as he was of Danconia Copper. "We are the only aristocracy left in the world, the aristocracy of money," he said to Dagny once when he was 14. "It's the only real aristocracy, if people understood what it means, which they don't." He had a caste system of his own. To him, the Taggart children were not Jim and Dagny, but Dagny and Eddie. He seldom volunteered to notice Jim's existence. Eddie asked him once, "Francisco, you're some kind of very high nobility, aren't you?" He answered, "Not yet. The reason my family has lasted for such a long time is that none of us has ever been permitted to think he is born at Danconia. We are expected to become one." He pronounced his name as if he wished his listeners to be struck in the face and knighted by the sound of it. Sebastian Danconia, his ancestor, had left Spain many centuries ago, at a time when Spain was the most powerful country on earth, and his was one of Spain's proudest figures. He left because the Lord of the Inquisition did not approve of his manner of thinking, and suggested at a court banquet that he change it. Sebastian Danconia threw the contents of his wine glass at the face of the Lord of the Inquisition, and escaped before he could be seized. He had left behind him his fortune, his estate, his marble palace, and the girl he loved, and he sailed to a new world. His first estate in Argentina was a wooden shack in the foothills of the Andes. The sun blazed like a beacon on the silver coat of arms of the Danconias nailed over the door of the shack, while Sebastian Danconia dug for the copper of his first mine. He spent years, pickaxe in hand, breaking rock from sunrise till darkness, with the help of a few stray derelicts, deserters from the armies of his countrymen, escaped convicts, starving Indians. 15 years after he left Spain, Sebastian Danconia sent for the girl he loved. She had waited for him. When she arrived, she found the silver coat of arms above the entrance of a marble palace, the gardens of a great estate, and mountains slashed by pits of red ore in the distance. He carried her in his arms across the threshold of his home. He looked younger than when she had seen him last. "My ancestors and yours," Francisco told Dagny, "would have liked each other." Through the years of her childhood, Dagny lived in the future, in the world she expected to find, where she would not have to feel contempt or boredom. But for 1 month each year, she was free. For 1 month, she could live in the present. When she raced down the hill to meet Francisco Danconia, it was a release from prison. "Hi, Slug."
"Hi, Frisco."
They had both resented the nicknames at first. She had asked him angrily, "What do you think you mean?" He had answered, "In case you don't know it, Slug means a great fire in a locomotive firebox." "Where did you pick that up?" "From the gentleman along the Taggart Iron." He spoke 5 languages, and he spoke English without a trace of accent, a precise, cultured English, deliberately mixed with slang. She had retaliated by calling him Frisco. He had laughed, amused, and annoyed. If you barbarians had to degrade the name of a great city of yours, you could at least refrain from doing it to me. But they had grown to like the nicknames. It had started in the days of their second summer together, when he was 12 years old and she was 10. That summer Francisco began vanishing every morning for some purpose nobody could discover. He went off on his bicycle before dawn, and returned in time to appear at the white and crystal table set for lunch on the terrace, his manner courteously punctual, and a little too innocent. He laughed, refusing to answer when Dagny and Eddie questioned him. They tried to follow him once, through the cold pre-morning darkness, but they gave it up. No one could track him when he did not want to be tracked. After a while, Mrs. Taggart began to worry, and decided to investigate. She never learned how he had managed to bypass all the child labor laws, but she found Francisco working by an unofficial deal with the dispatcher as a call boy for Taggart Transcontinental at a division point 10 miles away. The dispatcher was stupefied by her personal visit. He had no idea that his call boy was a houseguest of the Taggarts. The boy was known to the local railroad crews as Frankie, and Mrs. Taggart preferred not to enlighten them about his full name. She merely explained that he was working without his parents' permission and had to quit at once. The dispatcher was sorry to lose him. Frankie, he said, was the best call boy they had ever had.
"I'd sure like to keep him on. Maybe we could make a deal with his parents," he suggested.
"I'm afraid not," said Mrs. Taggart faintly. "Francisco," she asked, when she brought him home, "what would your father say about this if he knew?"
"My father would ask whether I was good at the job or not. That's all he'd want to know."
"Come now, I'm serious."
Francisco was looking at her politely, his courteous manner suggesting centuries of breeding and drawing rooms. But something in his eyes made her feel uncertain about the politeness.
"Last winter," he answered, "I shipped out as a cabin boy on a cargo steamer that carried Dunconia copper. My father looked for me for 3 months, but that's all he asked me when I came back."
"So that's how you spend your winters?" said Jim Taggart.
Jim's smile had a touch of triumph, the triumph of finding cause to feel contempt.
"That was last winter," Francisco answered pleasantly, with no change in the innocent, casual tone of his voice. "The winter before last I spent in Madrid at the home of the Duke of Alba."
"Why did you want to work on a railroad?" asked Dagny.
They stood looking at each other. Hers was a glance of admiration, his of mockery. But it was not the mockery of malice. It was the laughter of a salute.
"To learn what it's like, slug," he answered.
"And to tell you that I've had a job with Taggart Transcontinental before you did."
Dagny and Eddie spent their winters trying to master some new skill, in order to astonish Francisco and beat him for once. They never succeeded. When they showed him how to hit a ball with a bat, a game he had never played before, he watched them for a few minutes, then said, "I think I get the idea. Let me try." He took the bat and sent the ball flying over a line of oak trees far at the end of the field. When Jim was given a motorboat for his birthday, they all stood on the river landing watching the lesson, while an instructor showed Jim how to run it. None of them had ever driven a motorboat before. The sparkling white craft, shaped like a bullet, kept staggering clumsily across the water, its wake a long record of shivering, its motor choking with hiccups, while the instructor, seated beside him, kept seizing the wheel out of Jim's hands. For no apparent reason, Jim raised his head suddenly and yelled at Francisco,
"Do you think you can do it any better?"
"I can do it. Try it."
When the boat came back and its two occupants stepped out, Francisco slipped behind the wheel.
"Wait a moment," he said to the instructor, who remained on the landing. "Let me take a look at this."
Then, before the instructor had time to move, the boat shot out to the middle of the river as if fired from a gun. It was streaking away before they grasped what they were seeing. As it went shrinking into the distance and sunlight, Dagny's picture of it was three straight lines. Its wake, the long shriek of its motor, and the aim of the driver at its wheel. She noticed the strange expression of her father's face as he looked at the vanishing speedboat. He said nothing. He just stood looking. She remembered that she had seen him look that way once before. It was when he inspected a complex system of pulleys which Francisco, aged 12, had erected to make an elevator to the top of a rock. He was teaching Dagny and Eddie to dive from the rock into the Hudson. Francisco's notes of calculations were still scattered about on the ground. Her father picked them up, looked at them, then asked,
"Francisco, how many years of algebra have you had?"
2 years.
"Who taught you to do this?"
"Oh, that's just something I figured out."
She did not know that what her father held on the crumpled sheets of paper was the crude version of a differential equation. The heirs of Sebastian Dunconia had been an unbroken line of first sons who knew how to bear his name. It was a tradition of the family that the man to disgrace them would be the heir who died
leaving the Dunconia fortune no greater than he had received it. Throughout the generations, that disgrace had not come. An Argentinian legend said that the hand of a Dunconia had the miraculous power of the saints, only it was not the power to heal, but the power to produce. The Dunconia heirs had been men of unusual ability, but none of them could match what Francisco Dunconia promised to become. It was as if the centuries had sifted the family's qualities through a fine mesh, had discarded the irrelevant, the inconsequential, the weak, and had let nothing through except pure talent, as if chance, for once, had achieved an entity devoid of the accidental. Francisco could do anything he undertook. He could do it better than anyone else, and he did it without effort. There was no boasting in his manner and consciousness, no thought of comparison. His attitude was not, "I can do it better than you," but simply, "I can do it." What he meant by doing was doing superlatively. No matter what discipline was required of him by his father's exacting plan for his education, no matter what subject he was ordered to study, Francisco mastered it with effortless amusement. His father adored him, but concealed it carefully, as he concealed the pride of knowing that he was bringing up the most brilliant phenomenon of a brilliant family line. Francisco, it was said, was to be the climax of the Dunconias. "I don't know what sort of motto the Dunconias have on their family crest," Mrs. Taggart said once, "but I'm sure that Francisco will change it to, 'What for?'" It was the first question he asked about any activity proposed to him, and nothing would make him act if he found no valid answer. He flew through the days of his summer month like a rocket, but if one stopped him in mid-flight, he could always name the purpose of his every random moment. Two things were impossible to him: to stand still, or to move aimlessly. "Let's find out," was the motive he gave to Dagny and Eddie for anything he undertook, or "let's make it." These were his only forms of enjoyment. "I can do it," he said when he was building his elevator, clinging to the side of a cliff, driving metal wedges into rock, his arms moving with an expert's rhythm, drops of blood slipping unnoticed from under a bandage on his wrist. "No, we can't take turns, Eddie. You're not big enough yet to handle a hammer. Just cart the weeds off and keep the way clear for me. I'll do the rest." "What blood?" "Oh, that's nothing, just a cut I got yesterday. Dagny, run to the house and bring me a clean bandage." Jim watched them. They left him alone, but they often saw him standing in the distance, watching Francisco with a peculiar kind of intensity. He seldom spoke in Francisco's presence, but he would corner Dagny, and he would smile derisively, saying, "All those airs you put on, pretending that you're an iron woman with a mind of her own. You're a spineless dish rag, that's all you are. It's disgusting the way you let that conceited punk order you about. He can twist you around his little finger. You haven't any pride at all. The way you run when he whistles and wait on him. Why don't you shine his shoes?" "Because he hasn't told me to," she answered. Francisco could win any game in any local contest. He never entered contests. He could have ruled the junior country club. He never came within sight of their clubhouse, ignoring their eager attempts to enroll the most famous heir in the world. Dagny and Eddie were his only friends. They could not tell whether they owned him or were owned by him completely. It made no difference. Either concept made them happy. The three of them set out every morning on adventures of their own kind. Once an elderly professor of literature, Mrs. Taggart's friend, saw them on top of a pile in a junkyard, dismantling the carcass of an automobile. He stopped, shook his head, and said to Francisco, "A young man of your position ought to spend his time in libraries, absorbing the culture of the world." "What do you think I'm doing?" asked Francisco. There were no factories in the neighborhood, but Francisco taught Dagny and Eddie to steal rides on Taggart trains to distant towns, where they climbed fences into mill yards or hung on window sills, watching machinery as other children watched movies. "When I run Taggart Transcontinental," Dagny would say at times. "When I run Dunconia Copper," said Francisco. They never had to explain the rest to each other. They knew each other's goal and motive. Railroad conductors caught them once in a while. Then a station master 100 miles away would telephone Mrs. Taggart.
"We've got 3 young tramps here who say that they're..."
"Yes," Mrs. Taggart would sigh, "they are. Please send them back."
"Francisco," Eddie asked him once, as they stood by the tracks of the Taggart station, "you've been just about everywhere in the world. What's the most important thing on earth?" "This," answered Francisco, pointing to the emblem TT on the front of an engine. He added, "I wish I could have met Nat Taggart."
He noticed Dagny's glance at him. He said nothing else. But minutes later, when they went on through the woods, down a narrow path of damp earth, ferns, and sunlight, he said, "Dagny, I'll always bow to a coat of arms. I'll always worship the symbols of nobility. Am I not supposed to be an aristocrat? Only I don't give a damn for moth-eaten turrets and 10th-hand unicorns. The coat of arms of our day are to be found on billboards and in the ads of popular magazines."
"What do you mean?" asked Eddie.
"Industrial trademarks, Eddie," he answered.
Francisco was 15 years old that summer.
"When I run Dunconia Copper, I'm studying mining and mineralogy because I must be ready for the time when I run Dunconia Copper. I'm studying electrical engineering because power companies are the best customers of Dunconia Copper. I'm going to study philosophy because I'll need it to protect Dunconia Copper."
"Don't you ever think of anything but Dunconia Copper?" Jim asked him once.
"No.
It seems to me that there are other things in the world.
Let others think about them."
"Isn't that a very selfish attitude?"
"It is."
"What are you after?"
"Money."
"Don't you have enough?"
"In his lifetime, every one of my ancestors raised the production of Dunconia Copper by about 10%. I intend to raise it by 100.
"What for?" Jim asked,
in sarcastic imitation of Francisco's voice.
"When I die, I hope to go to heaven,
whatever the hell that is. And I want to be able to afford the price of admission."
"Virtue is the price of admission," Jim said haughtily.
"That's what I mean, James. So I want to be prepared to claim the greatest virtue of all, that I was a man who made money."
"Any grafter can make money."
"James, you ought to discover someday that words have an exact meaning."
Francisco smiled. It was a smile of radiant mockery.
Watching them, Dagny thought suddenly of the difference between Francisco and her brother Jim. Both of them smiled derisively, but Francisco seemed to laugh at things because he saw something much greater. Jim laughed as if he wanted to let nothing remain great. She noticed the particular quality of Francisco's smile again one night, when she sat with him and Eddie at a bonfire they had built in the woods. The glow of the fire enclosed them within a fence of broken, moving strips that held pieces of tree trunks, branches, and distant stars. She felt as if there were nothing beyond that fence, nothing but black emptiness, with the hint of some breath-stopping, frightening promise, like the future. But the future, she thought, would be like Francisco's smile. There was the key to it, the advance warning of its nature, in his face in the firelight under the pine branches. And suddenly she felt an unbearable happiness, unbearable because it was too full, and she had no way to express it. She glanced at Eddie. He was looking at Francisco. In some quiet way of his own, Eddie felt as she did. "Why do you like Francisco?" she asked him weeks later when Francisco was gone. Eddie looked astonished. It had never occurred to him that the feeling could be questioned. He said,
"He makes me feel safe."
She said, "He makes me expect excitement and danger." Francisco was 16 next summer, the day when she stood alone with him on the summit of a cliff by the river, their shorts and shirts torn in their climb to the top. They stood looking down the Hudson. They had heard that on clear days one could see New York in the distance, but they saw only a haze made of 3 different kinds of light merging together, the river, the sky, and the sun. She knelt on a rock leaning forward, trying to catch some hint of the city, the wind blowing her hair across her eyes. She glanced back over her shoulder and saw that Francisco was not looking at the distance. He stood looking at her. It was an odd glance, intent and unsmiling. She remained still for a moment, her hands spread flat on the rock, her arms tensed to support the weight of her body. Inexplicably, his glance made her aware of her pose, of her shoulder showing through the torn shirt, of her long, scratched, sunburned legs slanting from the rock to the ground. She stood up angrily and backed away from him, and while throwing her head up, resentment in her eyes to meet the sternness in his, while feeling certain that his was a glance of condemnation and hostility, she heard herself asking him, a tone of smiling defiance in her voice, "What do you like about me?" He laughed. She wondered, aghast, what had made her say it. He answered, "There's what I like about you," pointing to the glittering rails of the Taggart station in the distance. "It's not mine," she said, disappointed. "What I like is that it's going to be." She smiled, conceding his victory by being openly delighted. She did not know why he had looked at her so strangely, but she felt that he had seen some connection which she could not grasp between her body and something within her that would give her the strength to rule those rails some day. He said brusquely, "Let's see if we can see New York," and jerked her by the arm to the edge of the cliff. She thought that he did not notice that he twisted her arm in a peculiar way, holding it down along the length of his side. It made her stand pressed against him, and she felt the warmth of the sun in the skin of his legs against hers. They looked far out into the distance, but they saw nothing ahead except a haze of light. When Francisco left that summer, she thought that his departure was like the crossing of a frontier which ended his childhood. He was to start college that fall. Her turn would come next. She felt an eager impatience, touched by the excitement of fear, as if he had leaped into an unknown danger. It was like the moment years ago when she had seen him dive first from a rock into the Hudson, had seen him vanish under the black water, and had stood knowing that he would reappear in an instant, and that it would then be her turn to follow. She dismissed the fear. Dangers to Francisco were merely opportunities for another brilliant performance. There were no battles he could lose, no enemies to beat him. And then she thought of a remark she had heard a few years earlier. It was a strange remark, and it was strange that the words had remained in her mind, even though she had thought them senseless at the time. The man who said it was an old professor of mathematics, a friend of her father who came to the country house for just that one visit. She liked his face, and she could still see the peculiar sadness in his eyes when he said to her father one evening, sitting on the terrace in the fading light, pointing to Francisco's figure in the garden, "That boy is vulnerable. He has too great a capacity for joy. What will he do with it in a world where there is so little occasion for it?" Francisco went to a great American school which his father had chosen for him long ago. It was the most distinguished institution of learning left in the world, the Patrick Henry University of Cleveland. He did not come to visit her in New York that winter, even though he was only a night's journey away. They did not write to each other. They had never done it. But she knew that he would come back to the country for one summer month. There were a few times that winter when she felt an undefined apprehension. The professor's words kept returning to her mind as a warning which she could not explain. She dismissed them. When she thought of Francisco, she felt the steadying assurance that she would have another month as an advance against the future, as a proof that the world she saw ahead was real, even though it was not the world of those around her. Isla